Hello everybody, and for the final time in 2020, welcome to The Rut, the podcast which delves into the minds of men from all walks of life to try and find answers to some of the burning questions in and around men's mental health. You can check us out on YouTube, where you will find almost all of Season 2's episodes to watch, and while you're there, there is a lovely red button under our name which says subscribe. So it would be amazing if you could hit the subscribe button. We are going to bring you even more content, more interviews, more stories of people who are going through the ebbs and flows of life, overcoming adversity, and giving their perspective and their stories on their mental health, but also their journeys. So that would be the best Christmas present you could give us, actually. Bar, keep listening. I'd also just like to say a huge, huge thank you to every single one of you who continues to listen, download, support on social media, email us about this podcast and our mission. I mean, since we launched in May, we've literally had tens of thousands of people taking time out of their weeks to sit down and listen. So thank you for helping us grow. Thank you for being on this journey, and thank you for supporting us in 2020. We are so excited for an enormous 2021. As always, we are very, very, very pleased to be joined on this journey by Cornerstone. Cornerstone is your monthly men's health subscription box, providing you with everything you need to look, smell, and feel good every month. Handmade razors with titanium personalized handles, the most wonderfully smelling shaving cream and moisturizer I've genuinely had the privilege of trying, and loads more. I mean, there is shampoo, conditioner, Viagra, toothpaste, mouthwash. I mean, basically, imagine knowing at the start of the month that everything you need to be the best man you can be will turn up on your doorstep, and you literally don't have to do a thing. Unreal, right? Well, as a Rut podcast listener or viewer on YouTube, you can get £10 off your first box by going to www.cornerstone.co.uk/rut, or I will put the link in the show notes below, and you can find the link on our social media channels, Instagram, Twitter pages, etc. And get your box. You will not regret it. A couple of months ago, this guy who joins us this week for the final episode of 2020, this guy sat down with the Daily Mail and spoke about some of the battles he's faced as a rugby player and as a person with his mental health. Well, this week, we are going even deeper than that article, where Denny Solomona tells his story in his own words for the next hour and a half, and boy do we get deep. Denny has played both rugby league and rugby union, scoring the most tries in a single season, actually, in the history of the Super League for Castleford in the 2015-2016 season, with 40 tries. 40 tries in a single season. Like, mind-blowing. He then controversially moved to Sale Sharks 88 times for Sale, scoring 46 tries, which is still an incredible scoring record. He's also won 5 England caps, and parts of his story have been made public. However, we dive deep into the life of a prolific try-scoring rugby player, but somebody who has a life which is mixed with drugs, alcohol abuse, and pretty intense mental health battles. And we also explore how this man has got out of the ruts he's been in. So, Denny Solomona, welcome to The Rut. If you're listening to this, please leave all judgment at the door. Right, I think we're good to go. Denny, Thank you for taking the time. Welcome to the Rut. How are you?
Good. Thank you for having me. Yeah, I'm great. Thank you. I'm really good. Really good. Had a little nap, so I'm a proper recharge for this interview.
We're talking on a Wednesday, your day off. What's been the day like for you today?
Actually, we had a training day today. So because of this whole new COVID and whole new season, apparently to keep, obviously, the outbreaks like it happened last year,
yeah,
to a minimum, we've all got to test. Every prem team has to test on a Tuesday now. So Monday and Tuesday is pretty much pointless to the team because we can't train.
No.
We can't do nothing because...
It's recovery days, right?
Pretty much. And so until you get a test of all negatives, we then can train. So today was our first like proper day training in preparation for Northampton on Friday. So
today, how have you found lockdown?
To be fair, for us players, the first lockdown was quite the weird one because it went from playing to then having 3 months off. And then obviously we got, before everything was properly locked down, the club was being great. Everyone that needed a watt bike got a watt bike. Everyone that needed weights had weights. So
what did you
had the
take?
Tools. I didn't want to take nothing, but... I was forced to take a watt bike. So we did all these challenges just to try and keep fit. I was doing, that 5K donation, nominate five people and donate £5, just anything to keep me just occupied. But to be fair, I'm a home bird. I love it.
Oh, yeah.
I love being home. Any chance I get, I want to be home. I want to be chilling. And be relaxing. And my partner was heavily pregnant at the time. And so obviously we couldn't get drunk on the Wednesday just because you could. But it was Monopoly, countless amount of Monopoly, just little activities here and there, And when we could, obviously there was a period where you could have gone for one walk a day. We'd try and go for a walk. Obviously she was pregnant, so it was kind of limited, but the first lockdown was all right. I didn't mind it. I think it was the back end, and then obviously this one, it's not really a lockdown for us. We train, we come home, we're going to play on Friday. I think probably the only difference is there's literally nothing open. So me personally, this lockdown's been not too bad, mate.
I need to give a big shout out to Rob Shotton from Loose Heads, because he did say, if you don't give me a shout out on the podcast with Denny, he'll string me up by my bollocks. Appreciation for Rob Shotton, who's introduced us. You've got an unbelievable story. I don't know whether you fully appreciate it, actually. You probably do, because you've lived it for 27 years, but you do have a fantastically emotive story, actually, and one I'm very excited to dive into. I want to start by going back to exploring Denny Solomona as a kid growing up in New Zealand. From everything that I've read, this schoolboy prodigy, and I suppose that's probably carried on into your league and union career. What was life like for you growing up? What was the relationship like with your parents, and where did it all kind of start?
It started with just me wanting to play with my older brother Ben at the time. He's 2 years older than me. And then my dad, obviously retiring from his rugby career, he wanted to just stay in rugby, and he had obviously us four boys to have around and to train. And then unfortunately he chose Ben to coach his year. So obviously 2 years older than me. And I was just I was dead keen. I was why can't you coach me as well? He goes, no, because I coached the same year, different year, but on the same night. So you're going to have to go and get coached by someone else. So I think for the first couple of years, maybe I think I did from 5 to 6 or 7, I did. And then I think from 6 and 7, I was just like, Dad, I don't like this. I'm going off to my games.
What did you like?
Going off to your... I think I just wanted to be coached by my dad on a Saturday. I'd go and play with my brother, you know, just have fun. Like, for me personally, it was just a fun. And I was just like, oh, dad, like, no, I don't like it. I want to come get coached by you. And I want to come and like, obviously play with my brother. So he was like, yeah, fine. So that means you're going to come up and you're going to play two years above yourself. So you're going to have to like deal with that. I'm not going to go any softer on you than I am on, you know, my brother. And I think my dad created this like this atmosphere with me and my brother and my dad as a, it was already professional. So when I got there, we obviously drove in the same car, going to training, going to games, but he never really was our dad as soon as we jumped off that car. So you give us advice.
Did you like that or not?
Yeah, well, I think it just created that whole lot, especially because with parents and their kids, they're very protective. They're very opinionated.
Mm.
And if you to go to a sport event, any kid's sport event, the dads are always like, they're living their life through their kid and their little rugby game. Although the coaches obviously just put his hand up, said, yeah, I've got a bit of coaching experience. I've been playing a bit of rugby, so yeah. I can coach.
My dad, that's what my dad did. Yeah.
And people don't realize every person involved in a little a year eight game is all volunteers.
Mm.
But supporters, they have no idea. So obviously us being his sons and him being a coach, he didn't want them to feel like he took any favorites. So he picked it. If we played well, he picked us. If we trained well, he picked us. If we didn't, he dropped us. And it was just simple. And that's what kind of created for me. So unless I was training well and playing well, I can't play with my brother. I can't get coached by my dad. So luckily, we let our rugby speak for itself and we ended up playing well together and my dad just kept picking us. And we had a pretty good team. I'm still really good mates with, obviously, the year group that I was with. We had a girl prop as well called Sina Poaching. She ended up going to play for the women's New Zealand team.
Nice.
So, yeah, we I've kept in really good touch with most of the kids I used to play with. And they obviously went off to play some pretty decent rugby in their life as well. So it's just to be fortunate enough to get trained by my dad and play with my brother.
You got your first pro contract at 15, which for anybody it's a meteoric rise, right? That's not your normal. Well, at the moment, yes, it is. Okay, academy kids come through, they get picked up early doors. But do you know what? That's more football orientated. Now, you've actually said that other people, and I'm quoting you here, other people wanted me to be a rugby player. What did you want to be?
Well, that's the thing. I grew up rugby, sport, athletics. Anything I could have got my hands on physically, that's all I knew. And because I knew I was good at it, I didn't look anywhere else.
Right.
That was my thing. And I'm not saying it's my mom or my dad's fault. I think it should have been something there to at least help me with something else. What was my passion other than rugby?
What do you think your passion was other than rugby? Or have you got no idea?
Mate,
what did you enjoy back then, 15 years old?
Back then, literally, you know, what every other 15-year-old was just playing games, PlayStation, girls. My missus thinks that my brother was the stud muffin. I was just the nerdy brother that just
really
came along. But obviously, you know, we'll leave it there. But I was the stud back then, but no. To be fair, if I was to go back, I probably wouldn't know. I did enjoy like carpentry, so like obviously getting my hands on like a bit of, I don't know. See, that's the thing. I wouldn't know because I didn't really try nothing else.
Mm.
I just went to school for the sake of going to school because I couldn't drop out. I had to go to school, so I ended up going to primary school literally around the corner from my grandma's house. So we used to like go from a grandma's house into primary school. And primary school is great. I had a teacher that still smacked me because my grandma said it was allowed. So it's crazy. So my grandma took me into school one day, and obviously the teacher was in the same ethnic background as myself and my parents and my family. So she's told her in Samoan, if he's ever naughty, give him a smack. So obviously the teacher was like, yeah, I will. So I never stood a foot out of line with that teacher because I knew she was going to smack me.
Really?
And I knew she was allowed. So And then intermediate, I went to Papatoa Intermediate School. And then I went to college at Otahuhu College first. And then my older sister was there at the time, and my older brother. And it was kind of around that age where I kind of knew where I was going to go in life. And I knew rugby was probably my path.
But it sounds like it's what I'm trying to understand here, Denny, is it sounds like, okay, you've got your first pro contract at 15. And then from reading in between the lines, when you talk about other people wanting me to be a rugby player, it sounds like you weren't sure. You knew you were fucking good at it, but you weren't really understanding of probably what it takes. So from the age of up to 15 years old, I imagine you're like a happy-go-lucky schoolboy who's just scoring loads of tries for fun and basically just living the dream. And then you get to 16 and you start drinking.
Yeah, pretty much. So
what was the drink for you then? Where did the kind of path split, I suppose?
Roughly just in the same year. So I think I got a offer to sign with the Auckland Blues at the time.
Really?
At 50, yeah. So, and I was like, me and my dad, I was like, yes, I finally like made it. A kid that's come from, you know, a three-bedroom house with only one bathroom with like, what is it, five of us, seven or eight people.
Wow.
So to three rooms. So my mom and dad obviously got the one, my two girls got the two sisters had the one, and then all us boys were in the other. And it's to have something like that at that age and realize that I can finally provide for my family. And it was just a dream come true. So I was like, yes, I can't wait. Then some reason they just didn't get back. And then Melbourne Storm came. And Melbourne Storm's like, look, like we're going to be happy to sign you. What we want to do is obviously we'll bring you over and do pre-seasons with us first before you come over at the age of 18. So I was like, okay. So I was like, cool, that's fine. So I started doing that. And obviously as a 15, 16-year-old, you get this persona of, like, oh, you're going to be the man, you're going to be the best. So obviously I lived up to it, and I was just like, oh, okay, yeah. Like as a 15, 16-year-old, if you're surrounded by everyone that loves you, everyone that wants to be you, you end up having this cockiness about you, like, oh, yeah, I'm the fucking man, like, you know. So I bought into it. Well, hook, line, and sinker, I fell for it. I fell for the whole lifestyle of, yeah, I'm going to be this, I'm going to be that, I'm going to be this, I'm going to be that. And like you said, the timeline is very blurred for me, because from 15 to like now, it's still very blurred. And that's why I'm kind of erratic with my timelines, because it was just, it's a massive blur. And obviously drinking, it was just the pressure of it.
Right, okay.
I think at the time, I knew I was going to be the professional athlete that's going to provide for my family. So that pressure came upon me, where I think my older sister now kind of appreciates, kind of appreciates like the pressure I had, because my sister had to drop out and start work early to kind of help out with that kind of situation. So now my sister kind of like understood of the pressure that I was kind of feeling, because she was feeling that as well.
Can you remember like going back to like being, I appreciate it's kind of blurry, but I just, it'd be quite interesting to explore, like, what was drinking for you back then? Like, how did it affect your states? Because I can imagine it's quite confusing. You're about to sign, or you've signed for Melbourne Storm, right? And you're drinking heavily because the pressure of basically life, providing for your family, and the the trials and tribulations of being a professional. But can you remember what was going through your mind at the time?
At the time, I thought I was being just a rebel. I thought I was rebelling against my parents because obviously they were strict. They were like, look, you can't go out. You can't do this. You can't do that. And I just thought I was just being a rebel. And when you're like, obviously when you're rebelling against your parents, you do them things. But looking back at it, I wasn't just doing it for fun. I was getting like alcohol poisoning because I was drinking that much or drinking that stupidly. And because I was drinking, I had this whole alter ego. When I drank, I started getting really aggressive with everyone. So everyone around me, they'll look at me and I'll just like, what are you looking at? Why are you looking at me? Paranoia. I didn't know why I was like that. And it was crazy. And then because I started drinking, it kind of made me feel, because I blacked out, it was like, oh, okay, that was kind of, I kind of forgot about the pressure that I was under. So I was like, that obviously it hurt the next day because you're just throwing up for the rest of it, like for 2 days after because you had alcohol poisoning. But at the same time, I would rather throw up and, you know, and not feel the way I was feeling, the pressures that I was under, than to not drink at all. So that was the reason why I started. But obviously at the time, I didn't know it. I just thought I was just being a stupid 16-year-old that was just, you know, having the drink and sneaking out. And I was just lucky enough that my cousins were old. So old enough, like I think 22, 23 at the time. So they had their own place and, you know, I could safely go and drink with them.
Right.
So that for me, that was a good scenario. So I was obviously in a safe environment where I couldn't go off and get lost somewhere. And so I just let myself go there. And for some reason, they just kept having me back. So I was like, oh, cool. And then like went quiet for a bit. So for like 2 years, so from 16, 17, 18, it was like a bit of a chill period. Like I knew, obviously, I needed to train well. I needed to play hard because I needed to get into this first grade team. So at the time, when I signed my first contract at 15, it was for the under 18s. So Melbourne brought me over and I was like, look, like I'm ready to come, like move over. My mum got made redundant when I was 17, 16, around that time. So
did that have an effect on you? Did it put even more pressure on you financially?
Looking back at it, I didn't think it did because my mum, and when my mum got made redundant, they had a big paycheck. So basically they paid off all the debt that they're under. So I think for me, for that period, they're free. They're like, we've got no debt. We've got no nothing. All we need to do is pay for the mortgage that we had on the house. And so they were fine. So we're like, okay, cool. So me and my mom decided to move over first whilst my dad stayed there and saved up a bit more money to come over. And this is
moved to Australia. To move to
Melbourne. Yeah. So I called the general manager, Frank Panisi, at the time. And I was like, look, I know that you guys only want me when I'm 18 to play for the under 18s. And because in the times before, like obviously 16, 17, 18, they brought me over to do a pre-season with them. So I was doing pre-seasons with them and I was obviously getting involved and getting comfortable with their culture. And he was like, look, if you guys are willing to do it, we'll bring you over. We can, you know, you can either start playing for the under 18s at 17 if you want, and we'll go from there. And I was like, yeah, cool. So it started from camps, going over for preseason camps, going over for trials, etc. And then it went from actually moving. And it was all well and good, but it was like, it was very daunting for me to move into a whole new country, whole new place, make whole new friends. And I knew at the time that obviously I just had sport. My younger brother and sister were still in school. So I spoke with my mom and I was like, look, like we need to try and get him into a good school here so that obviously they can actually do well in school. The school we went to was a public school that, you know, everyone enrolls to around the area. And everyone that probably goes there knows that it wasn't the best school for academics. Like, and I knew my sister, my little brother, I needed to break that cycle of just going to school, finishing your year, and then not knowing what to do. So we moved over, my little brother and little sister. I ended up having to enroll into the school because they wouldn't have my little brother and sister without me going to the school. So it ended up being Glen Waverley in Waverley, you know, in Melbourne. We went and enrolled my little sister at the time. So my little brother was still going to like a primary school and intermediate before getting into the school. So they were like, look, my little brother's not at the age, but we want to enroll him later. They're like, no, that's fine. Denny's come here. So you guys are obviously the family. So you guys have come. And luckily my sister made a great impression on the high school there that she ended up obviously taking over my reputation and being like, oh, George, you're George's little brother, instead of, oh, you guys are Denny's little sister and brother. So because I didn't like school, I had to, so under 18s, we had to train at 6 o'clock in the morning, then catch a train back. And this was a sacrifice we all had to make. Every part of that 18 crew that we had to wake up at, you know, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, depending on where you lived. And some of the boys lived even further from me. And I don't know if you know him now, but Mahe Whanua, Kenny Bromwich. So all of them were all in the 18s, 20s at the time. And that was the kind of the exact same example that you had to go in beforehand and going after. And so when I was still in school, I had to go to training. 6 o'clock, it could be weights, depending on the temperature of the day. They'll either flip fitness and all your skill work in the afternoon to the morning, so that when you come back in the afternoon, if it's, you know, 35, 36 degrees, you can still go and train because you're doing all your outdoor work in the cold in the morning. So then we'll then have to go back, catch a train back home, try and get changed, try and get ready, go to school, finish school from 3 o'clock, then training will start at 5, 6:30 in the afternoon. So you have to travel from Glen Waverley to all the way into Richmond, which was where Storm's training ground is. And so that happened for a couple of years. And obviously everything in between was great. I had my mom.
And mentally at this stage, like, it sounds like you were just kind of getting on with it, right? It was this, we've come over to Melbourne. I'm continuing to live the dream. There is still the sort of pressure on you to, I suppose, be a success, given actually, do you know what? Yeah. Your parents and your family have given up a huge amount to come and move over to Australia. Did that ever dawn at you at any stage?
Yeah, of course. Like, obviously, I was the reason why they moved.
Yeah.
If I didn't have a contract to move to Melbourne, I don't think any of them would have come. I don't think they would have made a solid decision to be like, look, I think we should move to Australia, because I don't think it was ever on the table. So, yeah, it was just...
How did you struggle with identity at that stage?
It's because that's all who I was.
Really?
I was this guy that woke up at 2 o'clock in the morning. Sometimes I caught a ride off my dad. Sometimes I had to catch a taxi to the train station. So it was lucky that my dad worked at the airport at the time, because the airport's like literally the other side of Melbourne. So you either sometimes drop me off or drop me just to the train station, or drop me, you know, just right outside the door. Or I'll have to catch a taxi in the morning and get there on the train station. If I missed that train station by a minute, I would have been late completely. Or if I caught the one early, I'll be there. Like, I think it was the first train actually to leave Glen Waverley train station. So I think with identity, it was just because I was surrounded by rugby from a young age, going up, not finding a different hobby. If I found a different hobby or a different group of friends that was nowhere near involved with rugby, I may have found something else, and I may have found a different identity that other than the rugby player. And I feel like that's because I was so consumed into this role of either being the provider for my family, paying the rent that we're the house that we're in, and obviously being the success story that coming out from, you know, South Auckland where we grew up with, to making something out of nothing.
Yeah, to next to nothing, yeah.
Probably. Yeah, and so that was my identity struggle, was because I didn't find anything else other than rugby. And
did you, Denny Solomona, did you want to be a rugby player or not?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I did. But then it was at the point where I fell out of love with the game. And it was very quick as well. I think from when I started playing 20s, I was already training with the first team. And so when I played, so obviously we had a full-time contract with the first grade team, but I still played with the 20s. And I never had another job. So some of the 20s boys that trained with the first grade team that were like fortunate enough to play and train with them, they still had to go to work. So then my role was an apprenticeship. So basically I had to clean, you know, protein shakers, clean up after the training session, set up training. So me setting up training, you can imagine, like Melbourne Storm is probably the hardest three seasons I've ever done in my life.
Really?
And I think they pride themselves on, you know, training really hard, getting mentally strong. And then anything that you face in season is pretty much nothing compared to preseason. So imagine me as an 18-year-old setting up these hard hill sessions and these 2.3K time trials, knowing fully well I'm walking around setting up cones, knowing full well in an hour I'm going to be hurting and running around the things that I've set up. So it was a great experience, but I took it for granted. I was just, because I was always around the first grade boys, I was like, I'm the man.
Yeah.
And then I got injured. I broke my leg back in my hometown, New Zealand, playing the New Zealand Warriors in 20s. And then from there, I think it just kind of like, injury kind of just set my mind like a bit wobbly. I was like, do I actually enjoy this game? Do I love it that much to rehab on your own, wake up before everyone else and rehab, do all of this? I was like, for me personally, it wasn't for me. I hated rehab. Really? I hated, because anyone that plays professional sport, in especially a team sport, rehab's a very lonely place, mentally and physically.
I had Jack Willis and James Gaskell on the pod recently, and it sounds savage place.
And obviously, as a 20-year-old, 19, I think I was at the time, always at the fringe of making his first grade appearance, to getting injured and not fully recovering from that injury mentally and physically, it was damaging for me, because and my ego, especially my ego, because I was this next Billy Slater, because I was fullback at the time, and Billy Slater was in his prime, playing Queensland, playing State of Origin, playing Australia, and then literally backing it up on the same week and playing for club. Mm. So I was expected to play and, you know, jump into his boots every now and then when he was not wanting to play, because he's backed up on the Monday. So I was this next big protege of the next Billy Slater. And I was coming up with Cameron Munster at the time, that plays for Melbourne Storm now.
Mm.
And Christian Welsh as well, that's a prop for Melbourne. So it was all my 20s crew. And seeing Cameron Munster and all of that thrive now, I regret obviously not trying to put in a bit more. But at the time, it was just, for me, I was just like, I'm the next big thing. I deserve this. But why? Why did I deserve it? I just never found the answer.
Mm. How do you describe your ego?
At the time.
At the time, like, what was your relationship like with it? Because ego, just to give you context, I find ego fascinating. It can be the killer of some people. It can be the death of some people, but also it can be the one thing that drives people. And ego, I don't know if you've read Ryan Holiday's, like, ego is the enemy. It's super interesting topic, and it's for yeah, I just what's your
yeah, we can dive deeper if you want.
Yeah, go on. Well, what's your relationship like with the ego?
My relationship with my ego now is obviously a lot better than it was.
Of course, yeah.
Ego, as you say, is either can be the death or can be the drive. Mine was definitely the death. Mm. I think it's what drove me to be, drove me into that hole, because I expected the world, because I was guaranteed the world. Mm. So why do I expect the world? And then, so this ego was like building up throughout my, you know, 15, 16 year old to then my 20 year old. And as a 20 year old, you're like, why am I not starting it? Why haven't you given me a go? And I never understood why I did it. And then because I wasn't willing to listen to the answer to understand it, I was listening just to reply. So then again, you just no information was coming in. Everything was going out into the world. And then I kind of just got sick of it. And I was just like, look, I'm like, basically, fuck it. So I started drinking more. And then it was kind of around Melbourne area where Melbourne time where it kind of broke me to the point where I found out about this drug called cocaine. And obviously.
Oh, yeah.
and obviously, like, you know, MND, you know, ketamine, all of this sort of stuff. And I just found all of this out in Melbourne because I was looking for an escape to stop feeling this. I'm feeling like I've been betrayed by the club that was supposed to give me everything. But why?
That's but in what way? Because that's interesting, because you've had an injury, exactly. Right? Like, yeah.
Why should they?
No, because but it's like a clash of ego, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Just because I signed at 15 and I was in and around since I was 15, just because of that, like, no way. Like me, if I was to go back and be like, bro, just be patient, keep working hard, keep your head to the floor, your bum up, just keep one step at a time. Don't worry. But as a 20-year-old with the ego the size of the planet, it was never going to happen. It was never going to be a good scenario. And that's what kind of brought me to the point of where back to the identity is like, well, what else do I have? I've got nothing else. So I'm just going to have to just deal with it. So I dealt with it and sniff it. And it never really kind of left that whole behavior and the whole kind of, it was kind of a habit. It was kind of an autopilot of if I was feeling stressed or feeling a bit anxious about anything, I would drink. And because coming up to my 20-year-old, I was then told, I was like, look, your agent wants to have a word with you. We want to have a word with you. Melbourne, this is Melbourne. I think it's great if you can go off to Europe and play against men and have a bit of experience. And at the time, I was like, okay, so basically this is a loan deal. You're like, yeah, so you're going to go for a year, come back, and hopefully the experience will do you good.
What were your thoughts on that, given what we've just spoken about?
For some reason, I accepted it. Really? I don't know why. I should have said, no, I'm going to put my head down. I'm going to graft, and I won my shot at big time, at my first grade appearance. And at the time, I was just young and stupid. They'd never given me a go. I thought it was a personal attack on me. So I said, fuck it. I said, yeah, okay, I'm going to go. So I went. And what was it, 2014, 15, maybe? Yeah, I think around that time. So sorry, my memory, sorry, is obviously horrible. We got pumped every game, 60 points to...
This is the London Broncos, 60, right?
60 points to 20. Yeah.
Yeah, you should never have been in the
Super League. As a 20-year-old, that was drinking.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Drinking, drugs, everything, and then going into the Big Smoke, a town that never sleeps. It was probably the worst idea that I've ever had, but my family had no idea. My family just thought I was a young guy, had all this money, and I could just go and do whatever I wanted. I went and drunk. The drugs, they didn't even come up until I got fired from London Broncos. So it was at the time where London Broncos We're losing every week. I was miserable. It was winter. It was my first like full experience of England. And obviously in winter in England, it's dark at 3. And between probably 9 o'clock in the morning and 3 o'clock in the afternoon, that's the only sunlight you're going to have. So you're indoors in London. And to be fair, luckily I did have some good roommates, which was Till Atelevia and Nesiasi Mataitonga, which is two islanders. So it was kind of like a home away from home because I had similar cultures. They're a Tongan. And they also like to drink. So I was like, yeah, sweet. Like this is great. It's like having my cousin. So we ended up just drinking, having fun. I actually enjoyed it. I enjoyed meeting, obviously, the lads and having the experience of obviously moving halfway around the world. But to not have my family as that safety net, as what was spoken before, I used to go to my cousins at that safety net of getting as loose as I wanted, but my cousins were already there, so they'll look after me. I had none of that, no safety nets, no handcuffs, no one hand behind my back. I had two hands on my loose steering wheel, and I fully driven it off the cliff. So it was...
That's a really nice way of putting it, actually.
Yeah, so basically, really nice, you know, I always had that assisted, you know, one hand that always, hey, bro, you're going a bit to more the right. You need to stay in the middle.
Your Tesla's fucked up. I didn't have that.
Yeah, fucked it up. So basically, I just had a whole control of my life. So,
how long were you at London Broncos for? It was like a year. And then you moved to Castleford. And so through London Broncos, you're getting on the piss and sniffing again. Yeah. Generally speaking, with athletes or people who use alcohol and drugs is almost like a bit of an emotional crutch. It's their kind of go-to when things are shit.
Yeah.
There's this underbelly feeling or cycle within themselves of like self-loathing, like self-hatred, like, oh, you're such a fucking prick, right? Let's just go let's go and do 2 grams or whatever, or get a bottle of vodka in. Like, was that the type of relationship you were also having with yourself? Was there self-loathing, like complete hatred?
Yeah. And like I said, it all boils down to like, I didn't know who I was.
Like, yeah. Comes down to this identity thing again.
It's just, that's the whole underbelly of my whole depression, is this whole identity. And that's the only bet. That's the best way I can explain it, is this underbelly of the way I was feeling, this feeling was because who actually am I? If I was just to, like I said in my interview before, if I was to die, all I'll be known for is I was just a rugby player.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, and a son and a brother. But who actually am I? Am I, you know, I'm nothing else other than a rugby player. And yeah, and that's what kind of got me. My first year, if you wanted me to continue, my first year at Castleford, I was probably the most injury prone of my career. I think I was doing hamstrings. I did my PCL. I did my syndesmosis at the time. So injury prone first year. And I was like, what the fuck's going on here? I was like, okay, well, what am I doing? So I started drinking more.
Yeah, because we already know that rehab, you fucking hate rehab. Yeah,
you know, I wouldn't turn up for my rehab. I'll just be like, no, I can't be asked today. I'm literally not going to go. I'll turn up to training. He'll try and get me into the rehab room, and I'll just be like, nah, I can't. I need to go and sit outside and just look at the boys whilst they train. But obviously, physios being what they need to do, they're like, look, okay, we'll open the doors, we'll open the windows, we'll put all the gear outside, we'll try and make you as involved as we can. And it's like, yeah, thanks, mate. So they compromised with me, and that's what kind of got me through a bit of it. But majority of it, I was back within probably a month before I should with any injury that I had. My PCL, you could play straight away, so I wasn't really bothered with that. But my syndesmosis, my right ankle at the time, I still couldn't walk, like probably walk on it properly. But I was like, look, just jab me up, put a local anesthetic in it, strap it, and I'll just play because I can't deal with it. I can't face the demons alone. because when I do face my demons, it's either I just drink it away or I sniff it away. So that's how I dealt with it at the time. And then throughout that period, it was like just multiple times of just trying to drink it, sniff it. And then there was a time where luck.
Sorry. And I'm fascinated by this because it's super interesting. Let's say you finished, you've played for Castleford, you've finished training, right? And, or you finished rehab and you've gone home and you've got a bottle or a couple of lines and like you've done them. What was the aftermath like the next day? Because I can imagine was there any regret from your side? Were you thinking, fuck, I shouldn't have done that? Or was it just, do you know what? Fuck this. I don't give a fuck.
Yeah, literally, I couldn't give a fuck.
Really?
No, I wake up, I just like, oh, okay, yeah, I'm a bit hungover. I'm all right. I'll take a couple of paracetamols, I'll drive to training. And it was just a constant repeat. Drive to training.
Did your teammates know?
No, it's because I did it, like I said, I was doing it at home on Tuesday night, right. A couple of bottles of red.
Christ.
And I'll sniff, and then I'll just keep going. I'll just keep drinking. At the time, I was single as well. And obviously, it was just bad. It's a bad time for me. When I remember it, it's very horrible for me to have done all these things. And it was just, it's crazy. I was either drinking, sniffing, or sleeping with someone. Mm. And from a small town, it's crazy. And it was a constant on repeat. It was the same story, same day, different day. And it was just like that. And then I wouldn't say my ex was the reason why I had such a good year. It was only because it was like the way of the universe giving me a heads up, being like, she came into my life being like, hey bro, like, you know, you kind of got to sort your shit out.
Yeah.
Or basically do one, go back home. So it wasn't,
she sounds like a bit of a godsend, to be honest, at the time.
But that's the thing, at the time. So let's just fast forward for a second. So Ollie, the guy at Save Your World, if you look him up, Save Your World, he's done a lot with me in the last.
Who was Save Your World? Before I met
Ollie.
Who was Save Your World?
So it's a group. So a group of us lads that kind of buy into this whole higher purpose, universe,
right? Yeah, sure.
Ego. Okay. So you're getting more in touch with all that side of things,
with basically true self,
down
the
rabbit hole. Yeah,
yeah,
and. So when I moved to Sale, I think 2 years after last year, actually, that he kind of, I've not cried like that with another guy ever in my life.
What sparked that conversation? Because to be honest, in chronologically speaking, in the timeline, you've had this unbelievable season at Castleford where you've broken every single record in Super League history in terms of try scoring, and yet you were in one of the worst places imaginable mentally, which is just amazing. And then you meet your ex-wife.
Yeah.
And it's almost like they're like the kind of heavens open for a second, and this beam of light shone on her, and in a very good way. It sounds like she was a good person for you at the time. And we can get on to, don't have to get on to that much.
Yeah.
But
we definitely can.
Yeah. And so you're still at Castleford when you've met her, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So with our relationship, I mistaken.
How did you meet her first and foremost?
So it was a friend of mine. So he lives down in London, and his partner was friends with her.
Right.
We went from there, and then started from obviously a cheeky DM, in there. And then for me personally, I think I'm mistaken gratitude with love. So because that's she came at the time,
so interesting.
Yeah. So this whole time, you know, I was grateful, and I mistaken that gratefulness for coming in and, you know, trying to just help me out, just trying to set me straight. And just basically, like we were saying, if we want to use the analogy, help me with that steering wheel back into the middle. So I've gone too far right. I'm mistaken it for love. And it just went on and went on and went on. And then I kind of didn't realize it till it was too late. And this too late was obviously me cheating on her. And I didn't realize that gratefulness can kind of manipulate itself as a feeling of love. And
yeah,
100%. Only until I spoke with Ollie, and his, obviously, is if you want to go after this, his Instagram, Save Your World. He kind of put in perspective of the way I was feeling throughout the relationship is because I felt like I had something to repay to her. I felt like my life was just, I need to repay this woman back. So you're going to be my wife. That's simple.
Repay her because she's been so kind as to pick you up off the floor.
She was there when I was at my lowest, and she picked me up and she helped me. And that's what I mistaken it for. And, you know, I can't knock her off. She was a great girl. And obviously I treated her horribly. But then it just wasn't for me. I think it was when the bad times were bad, it was horrible.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And you can imagine, like, all these in tune people now, they can call it a toxic relationship. And at some points it was, even when it was good, sometimes it'll be toxic. Sometimes, you know, it'll be good. And that's where it kind of was at for a long period of time. And obviously she was in this limelight of a reality TV star. I was just this guy that wanted to play rugby and chase a pill around for a living.
From South Auckland.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
And it was crazy. Like, when I first met her, like, again, I fully bought into her lifestyle. Like, all these cameras were taking photos, and I was just like, oh.
Did you enjoy it?
Man. Yeah. Well, my ego.
Ego speaking, ego, yeah, yeah.
So now resurrection of my stupid ego came out and just like, yeah, bro, I love this one. Like, let's get it. Let's ride this wave. Let's take it. And then it was just from there, she wanted to have more. So the only income she can have is obviously more TV shows.
Of course, yeah.
And the only TV shows, because she first aired on X on the Beach, is that's where, like, she was known from. So then again, she was like, oh, I'm going to bring out this activewear, this gym wear. The only way I can get it on is if I go on X on the Beach. But the only way I can go on X on the Beach if I'm single. So I was like, well, we're married. You can't. And then she's like, no. Okay, but don't worry. Like, I'm going to be faithful, but I just need to pretend like we're single. So her agent at the time was like, no, Jess, you can't be with Danny at all. So we pretended to be single throughout the whole basically marriage of our life.
How did that make you feel?
Obviously horrible, because in our whole life was basically hidden from everything. And for me personally, like at the time, like I was talking about ego, like my ego wanted to be out there. You want to be like, no, let's go be shown together so I can read myself in the newspaper the next day. That's what I wanted. But as a relationship point of view, I didn't want it at all. I was like, no, but we're married. If you can't go get on anything, if you're married, then what's the point? Like, you might as well just split. And then she was like, no. Like, this is the only way I can get money. Like, I need to do it. And I was like, fuck. Okay, fine. Like, don't worry, you just do it. So she went on X on the Beach, and she was gone for a while. And obviously me being alone and me having a previous to just getting off the rails, it kind of broke me, because I was like, it was almost like she was my comfort zone. So yeah. I knew if she was there, I won't do anything of that. And because she wasn't, I was just like, oh, well, fuck it. I'm just going to drink. So obviously the drug stopped when I moved to Sale. And that's when I met her, was because it was that period of moving to Sale after that good year I had. So with Sail, I've ended up finding out these things called sleepers, and they're called tremadol and diazepams and muscle relaxants and all of these things. So I was taking, you know, three or four tremadols, three or four diazepams, and a couple of bottles of red wine. And
you've spoken about how good Steve Diamond's been since you've been in Sale.
And like I said, I'm grateful for him. And obviously now I know, obviously, I don't love the guy.
You know, but you're not going to ask him to marry you. He'd probably turn around and tell you fuck off.
Exactly. He'd probably chin me. But, you know, and I'm grateful for the bloke. Like, he's done so much for me.
He gets a bad rap, actually, Steve Diamond, in many senses.
Yeah, I think it's because he speaks his mind. He speaks to what, like, he's not filtered.
No, he's confrontational as well.
Exactly. And I think that's the reason why, is because no one likes confrontation. And if you're seen being confrontational, you're labeled as a dick. And unfortunately, he's labeled as it. But if you really get to know Steve, he's a great dude. And he's very understandable. He understood my situation, and he understood even before I moved. I said, look, mate, I struggle with my mental health. So this whole scenario, I'm not going to be comfortable with. And he's like, Steve, being Steve, goes, fuck him. I'm going to look after you. You just do what I tell you to do and you'll be okay. So he gives me the Sail Sharks van to move all my shit from Castleford to Warrington, where I live now. And he knew what was going to happen because it's got Sail Sharks logo on the side of the van parked outside my house, moving stuff. So everyone's like, what the hell is Denny doing? Like, where is he going? And obviously Sail Sharks logo, shark is literally plastered to see on everyone's face.
Because obviously you leave Castleford in a bit of an infamous cloud of smoke, right? Like obviously the ensuing court case which happened, but it seemed like the right move for you at the time. I mean, at the end of the day, you've gone off the rails at Castleford, but you've scored an absolute ton of tries. And why Union? Is it just because Sale came in interested?
No, it's because I played, obviously, when I was growing up, that's what I played.
Oh, right. Okay.
So it was only till I finished school. So when I moved to Melbourne is when I started playing rugby league.
Right.
So I used to play rugby league on a Sunday with I had a good family friend called Vaya Bloomfield. He sadly passed, and his son called Elias. He was like, mate, and we went to school together at Odu College, and he was like, bro, do you fancy playing league? And I was like, whatever, like, I'm keen for anything. I was young, I could recover, you know, straight away. So we used to play rugby league on the Sunday and first 15 on the Saturday. So that's what I kind of understood league as well. So when Melbourne came, I was like, yeah, look, I've played it. I'm keen. Let's go. And then obviously that decision to go back to rugby union was always at the back of my mind, because that's my first love. It was like, and
is that the moment you kind of feel like you're being the real Denny?
Yeah, because I made the decision for me.
Yeah. And not for anybody else. Because you've mentioned a few times.
Not for my family, not for anyone. Because I didn't have my family was halfway around the world. I didn't have to call up my mom and dad and be like, look, this is what I think. I was 21 or 22 and I need to make a decision for my own life.
Mm.
So that was kind of like a first stepping stone into finding out who I really am and who I want to be as a man. And I decided to make this decision based on who I wanted to be and what I wanted to do. Obviously, it was a lot earlier than I expected, because Castleford, I can't speak about the exact details because I've signed a legal paper. NDA, I couldn't. So at the time, I asked Castleford for the amount I was rightly probably marketed in any other team. And they point blank refused. So I said, look, I'm going to leave then. You know, this is what's going to happen. I'll leave. I'll find another club. They threatened me, which They did. And I said to them, like, look, that's fine. Like, you know, I'm happy to sign a transfer fee, which I'm sure most teams would have paid for me at the time. And
yeah, I mean, fucking hell, scoring 40 tries a season. I think yeah, everybody would have, yeah.
I think the most, I didn't think scoring the most tries was my accolade on that year. I think it was being in contention for Man of Steel.
Really?
I think that's what kind of, I was just like, fuck. Like,
yeah. I've had a you know, that's
three people out of the whole Super League. I was in there to win the best player that year in Super League. And for me personally, that was the biggest personal accolade that I could ever had. Like, I, you know, a try scoring for me is a team accolade. The left side we had was dangerous. But, you know, put us left edge in any team with scoring tries, 100%.
Really?
We had Junior Moores, Luke Gale, Luke Dawn, and Jake Webster, and me, myself. We're dangerous, man. Like, if I was their right winger, I'll be shaking in my boots, mate.
Really?
Like, me, all I need to do is put the ball down. That was all I needed to do. The brains was Luke Gale and Luke Dawn. The brute force was Junior Moores, Ollie Holmes, and Jake Webster. If you look at the clips, obviously it's all on YouTube. Some tries, obviously, I have to work for, but most of the tries, cheapest. The boys done a great job. And that's why I find the try scoring accolade as a team, as a left edge accolade, because without them, I wouldn't have been in them situations to even put the ball down.
Yeah. You've talked a bit in the past about contracts, stats on the pitch. They're just kind of a number in the business.
Yeah, yeah.
What did you want to be, though?
As in what?
Well, from that kind of that statement, I'm just a number in the business. I mean, what did you expect? What did you want to be?
I wanted to be the one man club. I thought Melbourne was going to be the one club I stay at. I'm going to be the next Billy Slater that, you know, comes through the ranks. They're going to put a statue outside of the stadium for the amount of services I've done for the club. That's what I expected.
Okay.
And that's what I expected. And that's probably why it hit me harder, not having an opportunity to even do that. And then come in Carlton, exact same. I was like, jeepers, this is great. This is going to be, like, you know, I'm going to put my stamp here and they're going to remember me forever. And now instead of remembering me for a good thing, they remember me for the most horrible thing to do. But in any scenario, if some business came to poach you as an employee, would you ever let down an income that could provide for you for the rest of your life? No. But it's only because and the way it kind of got portrayed into the papers is that I'm this bad guy, but I'm just another cow on the conveyor belt that's just ready for slaughter.
Mm.
But if you flip it and if a company was to do what I did to them, they'd be like, oh, it's just business. Great business. You know, get... you know, 250,000 for Denny and you buy five other players. That's great business. But, jeepers, my phone's going to die. But for me personally, it was just a personal attack. Like, I'm this bad guy. And it kind
how long
of...
Have we got, how long have we got until your phone dies?
No, you're all right. We're all good. It kind of like, I'll just charge it anyway. We're only in the middle of this story, my friend.
No, here we go.
You know what I mean? Like, it's just like that whole thing of that social media, which I find very horrible now, is that it's the drive for personal attacks. And I was reading Twitter like day in, day out, the words that were said, I was living them. I was feeling them. Snake, C word, you know, Judas.
What did that do to you?
It fucked me up mentally.
Really?
Because my mental state wasn't good at all anyway to even start with. But then to add this whole pressure of all these people that probably I've met but not really paid attention to, and I probably won't even see again.
No, nor because, do you know.
Exactly. But because of all these people saying all these things, it was like it was a personal attack. Like I knew him. It was like my family was saying that to me. That's how I took it. And then fortunate enough, I had a great season at Sale. I ended up scoring tries. I ended up debuting that same year. And this is what people struggle to understand, is that how can I have had a 40-plus try scoring season, a Man of Steel contention, but feel the way I feel?
Still suffering from depression.
Exactly. And I was like, this is not something that just goes away. This is not something that you can just magically click your fingers, take a pill, take a drink, and it goes away. Like, I struggled with it by myself for the
How do you describe your depression? Because a lot of people that I come on to this podcast, they can describe it relatively succinctly and express it, and others can't. It's this like out of body experience a lot of the time. But yeah, how would you describe the feeling of depression which ran throughout? I'd probably say from 20 to 24. It's like four or five years. It's a long time.
I think I'll be one of the guys that said it was like an out of body experience. Like, it was just, I can't put a finger on why I was feeling it. And that's what I didn't understand, is like, why was I feeling so sad and so miserable when the world was at my feet, scoring tries, winning games? Basically, the whole rugby league community knew who I was. And that's all what I've wanted for. That's literally the fame that I've wanted, to make sure anyone that got mentioned, like my last name, Solomona, anyone that said that last name, that they will know who I was. And why was I feeling so sad? Why was I feeling like I needed to drink my life away? Why was I feeling like I needed to put a hole through my nostrils? It baffles me even to think about it now, is because if you meet me now,
yeah, different person.
It's like,
how do you reflect back on it?
Obviously, it's a big journey. It was a very, very big journey, and it was a crippling journey at the same. Like, it was like, obviously, times were that tough that I was, you know, attempting to try and commit suicide, because it was horrible. And that, I think that's what was making it worse, is because I knew I had a great life, but then at the same time, this feeling inside me was eating me up. I was like,
mate, I was totally the same. And I felt this like indomitable sense of guilt and shame and burden constantly.
Yeah.
Even though I was looking at myself like, okay, yeah, I've went to a private school, like I've got lived in a 5-bedroom, my parents live in a 5-bedroom house, 2 dogs, great girlfriend, like great friends, but it doesn't matter. I was in a place where, do you know what, I could have jumped off Putney Bridge, no problem. No problem.
Yeah, I agree. And that's the exact same as for me, is that there's this, and it's still there, it's still here. I still have it, like, really? Every now and then. And what's fortunate for me is now with me and Holly. Holly's great. And when I was talking with Ollie before, the guy of some Savior World, kind of made me realize, like, people come into your life for different reasons. It's either a lesson, or you're gonna, you know, obviously, that's your person. And when I learned all of this whole self-worth, you know, mental health, obviously learning more in depth about it, and just creeping down the rabbit hole, is the more I learned about ego, about everything else, and how to stay connected and stay woke, basically. How, I know it's a bit cringe because everyone's like this whole thing, but as cliche as it is, there's people that are still sleeping. There's still people that have clicked this autopilot in their mind, and they're just going about business, going about their 9-to-5 job, go back home. You know, that's it. That's all they do. But he's officially woke me up to the way I feel, how to in tune the way I feel, and how to deal with it now. And
okay, that's interesting. And part of the kind of, I suppose, the mantra of this podcast is obviously we explore how the fuck you got into your ruck, rut, what it was like being there, which we've kind of done at length as well, which has been fascinating, and also how on earth you got out of it. And you have got out of it, albeit there are moments where for me sometimes during the day a suicidal thought will creep into my head and I'm like, oh hello, you're back, and like that's normalized for me, and that's something I accept. But for you, what was the process of getting out of your rut, like moving away from booze, moving away from coke, like, and then obviously it sounds like Sale and Steve Diner have been amazing, but what's been that process of learning self-worth? How did you do it?
Cry.
Really?
Cry. Yeah. Obviously there's this whole persona around crying. It's like males don't cry, men don't cry, men emotions, and men is not a, it doesn't go, it's not 1+1. You know, that's what people think. And all Ollie, basically the first 3 meetings I've had with Ollie, it was just crying. Constant crying and trying to dig deep and find the pain, live in it, breathe in it, actually accept the pain for who you are. Because because I'm constantly neglecting this pain, it's the reason why we're feeling the way we are.
And just running.
If I accept this pain, exactly. If I head straight for this pain, live in it, breathe in it, I'm going to accept it, and it's going to accept me, and it's going to identify that it's okay to sometimes feel sad. It's okay to sometimes wake up and on a perfectly beautiful day and feel like you want to absolutely ruin yourself. But, and that's where we get out of our rut, but that's the perfect thing, is because you're so in tune with it, it helps you be like, okay, so I have Mick Farrell as a team psychologist at our club at the minute. I've got a perfect support network around me now that as soon as the day I even wake up and feel like that, it's instantly nipped in the bud. It's instantly spoken to.
Really?
You know, sometimes it doesn't happen until I get home and I've had a tough day on my feet. You know, something has annoyed me at training. Get home. I just ask Ollie, I said, can you just cuddle me? Or I just snuggle up to my little girl. And, you know, it's amazing how much it has changed from even like, and now I can actually drink and not black out. I can actually drink and just
enjoy. You've got a better relationship with alcohol.
And enjoy the taste of an alcohol instead of, This is a Jack Daniels. This is a wine bottle. Like, it doesn't even, I didn't even care at the time. As long as it got me drunk, I didn't care.
That's going now, down
too. Yeah, and that's what. And now it's amazing because it was identifying the pain, the source of the pain, the reason why I was feeling depressed, which was like we go back to the identity, and because I was thought, and the pressures that it came with rugby. Put on myself, and I put on myself. And so that was my pain. That was a source of everything. Because I didn't deal with it then, just because I didn't say, Dad, can we just ease up? Can we just have a chill? Can we have a chat? Can you kind of just chat me through this? I did it all on my own. And that's the thing, that's what I hate, that if I was to go back, I wish I did.
Which is why the Lucid message has resonated so much with you, let's just constantly talk about it.
Especially in rugby, is because that's who I was. And I'm in the works of doing my own now as well. So I'm going to open up, and we're going to go to, you know, academies, you know, training camps. You know, when clubs open up training camps to, you know, some parents just drop their kids off because they want a day off.
Yeah.
It'll be aimed at kids coming through rugby, going to schools, going to sports schools. And I'm going to start obviously opening up a bit more in my experience, just to hopefully help the next generation or the next me, the next 15-year-old that is coming through, that I can hopefully help. Because, you know, if I can help one little kid, might 100%. Save his life. And so that, for me personally, that's what's in the works now. And obviously from me getting out of it now, I found that rainbow at the end of the storm, which is my little family, Holly and Rue.
How long did it take? And
what, getting out of it fully?
Well, yeah, this process, because some people it takes a couple of years. Other people it's like, Jesus, right, we've had 4 therapy sessions and you know what? I'm in a great place now.
To be fair, I think it was at least 6 months it took me, but it was a hard 6 months. Like I was saying, the first 4 sessions, I was just crying. You know, and that's what people need to understand, is that it's not an easy road.
No.
You don't just look at me and be like, oh, okay, he can get through it. But it's easy. It's going to take a lot of work like for yourself. Like, this is what I've always said, like, no one can do the work for you. Everyone can hold your hand through that journey, but no one else can do that inner work for you. You've got to wake up with yourself, because no one else is going to wake up with you and constantly be there. But you have to do the inner work for yourself. You've got to choose to go through that pain before you get to the other end.
Would you give to like a younger Denny or a 15-year-old kid growing up who's the next Denny Solomona at that age?
Obviously, ego is probably going to be one of them. Identify what your ego is at the minute, sort it out, make sure you work in tune with that, and just be patient with yourself. Like, obviously, don't be so hard. When you grow up, everything needs to be a certain way. Like, your parents, like, you need to go to school, you need to do this, you need to do that. Sometimes it's just taking a step back, having a day off, and just being like, actually look at your life from a third person and just be like, just love yourself, be patient. If things don't go your way, don't let it get to you so much, because that's what I feel like. Which was lucky is that younger kids now are getting more in tune with their feelings. And that's what I found with doing these workshops, is that I found that they're a lot more better than obviously us olders, is that they're happy to speak to their parents now. I think it's that kind of side of things has changed a lot. And nowadays they're happy to speak about their feelings, which is great, which is obviously the first step to obviously stopping this and preventing this, is that speaking is probably the best thing. So yeah, my advice is obviously speak and be patient and just love yourself. I think that's the biggest one, is love yourself. Be easy on yourself. Times are going to get tough. It's not your fault. You don't purposely go and ruin whatever situation you're going to be in. And that's probably my number one.
You've also got quite an interesting insight into like Samoan culture, right? Because from the islanders that come and play in the Premiership, but all around the world, a specific island culture is something which it's not very secular in the sense that it's got faith, that it's underpinned by faith, right? And I can imagine for your family listening or reading Daily Mail article or listening to you speak to them about your problems, that might have been quite a tough thing for them to go through, given the whole culture within the Pacific Islanders around talking but being respectful and not wanting to show weakness, etc. What was it like?
It was actually obviously daunting, because I didn't know how they were going to take it. Sorry. Good night, my love. Love you.
I feel awful.
No, it's okay. She's just going to bed. Good night, my
love. Good night, Rue.
Yeah. She didn't. Yeah. She'd be naughty. Mwah, love you. It was obviously daunting, because, and that's the we go back to the way, the conflict of feelings, is because why did I feel so bad when I have this amazing family? And why do I feel like it wasn't my family's fault at all, but it was the pressure that came with it. if that makes sense. It was like that whole, essentially the family was, it was the reason why, but my family actually wasn't. It's because I put the pressure on myself thinking of my family.
Your experience of how you live through life. Yeah.
And so, yeah, no, like you said, faith underpins my faith in God and religion. And we put full faith in God that he provides the way, he paves the way. And just like all the islanders before me, they've paved the way for me in the Prem. It's probably, you know, it's the hardest thing, is because it only takes till now. And, you know, you can see on Twitter now that the fight for Pacific Islanders and equal rights within the rugby.
Mm.
Now, and I don't want to go in too depth into that because it's just a whole new story.
Oh, but yeah. I literally last night I watched Dan Leo's new film.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is a part cracking.
And that's the exact reason, is because
really
it's not just our family. It's obviously some boys have the whole country on their shoulders.
Mm.
And you can imagine how much pressure that creates. And that's the sort of troubles we kind of face, is that if we don't change this whole, like, obviously the whole culture doesn't have to change, but the whole culture of having to rely on your bottom feeding the top, which is your, you know, everyone feeding upwards, giving money back home, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, where we can change that culture and make sure that the generation that plays the rugby now gets paid and sets themselves up so that their next generation, their family, their kids grow up, that they don't have the pressure to have money to play sport to have money. They can just play sport to enjoy the sport. They can be like, oh, okay, I'm not financially like struggling. I don't have to find what I love to turn it into something of a job. So I don't have to go out and find money straight away. I can then find myself, my identity, who I am, and go from there. You know, and that's the culture we live in. Like, although I love my culture, I'm proud to be Samoan, but that's the sort of things we need to change, is that we need to change the generation now to then come further on in the line, is that we don't have any other islanders that struggle a lot with it. And most struggles with islanders and mental health is because of the pressures that they put on themselves, because they've got family to feed back home.
How big a problem is it, mental health with an island?
It's massive.
Really?
Massive, massive, massive. Throughout my time here in England, there's been about 4 or 5 islander young boys that take their lives back home in Australia with the NRL. And
shocking.
That's from what I know. That's from who I know as well. And I lost a really close friend of mine through that as well.
Sorry to hear that. God.
Yeah, so it's, and that's how bad it is. Obviously, it's bad. I'm not saying it's a race that's struggling with it the most. Saying for the purposes of,
no, of course,
the pressure that it comes with is because
the rugby in Tonga, Fiji, yes, Samoa, yes, is the national sport. It's just, you go one of two ways, really. With, and watching Dan Leo's film last night, it really hit home. You really do go one of two ways if you want to be a rugby player from the islands. It's, you either go and get a contract in New Zealand or Australia or in Europe, or you try and work your way through in Samoa. But it rarely ever happens that way.
No, it's because first you're going to find someone that will pay your flight. We're not the richest country. We're people that still grow veg back garden. We're still people that, you know, live on trading. Like, it's still like that back home, back in Samoa, back in Tonga, back in Fiji. And obviously Fiji might be a bit more fortunate. They've got beautiful islands, beautiful resorts. So, but obviously it doesn't go into a sole singular person that wants to be a rugby player.
Mm.
So the struggles is all still there because, yeah, it is only two ways. It's either you get like Semi Radraja, for an example. You know, he came straight from Fiji, went straight into Parramatta Eels, had a killer of a season, and that's how they know him because he went from Parramatta. But where was he before?
No.
A kid in Fiji. Like, that's what he was.
But same as Rupeni Thathambuka. I mean, like, that story is so brutal. I mean, he was genuinely one of the best players in the world. Like, that 2003 World Cup where he tore it to shreds. He was a freak. And now look at him. He's like, he's got nothing. Genuinely nothing. I was watching that film. I was like, how has this even happened? But again, it's, we could do a whole nother pod. Maybe we should do a whole nother pod.
Okay. Let's
do it. It's a savage world.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I'm glad to have lived my experiences and have that sort of knowledge to then pass on. And, like, you know, people like you, you know, grateful for, because you guys are also spreading the awareness through your podcast. And you're also another living, you know, breathing example. There's always light at the end of the tunnel. And it's not just pain. It's also beauty. You can also turn it into a positive thing, because if you're also struggling, you speak to your missus, she can also be struggling as well. And I feel like that's the beautiful thing about this whole movement that we're doing, that we can actually make this what seems to be a negative persona as a positive thing that we can all go through.
For me, mental health, Denny, like, I don't know about you, but for me, mental health, there's, especially in men, there is so much more understanding and education that needs to be done. That's what I'm really seeing at the moment. A lot of my friends who've never experienced depression, anxiety, or mental illness, mental health problems, they're like, "What's it like?" And I'm like, "I'm like, fuck, it's so bad."
Yeah. Like me personally, because I went into England, and it was my first time. I've not played rugby for long, or professional rugby for long. I was this new kid on the block. My anxiety levels was crazy. It's like starting a new school, jumping straight into, like, let's say you were in year eight, you had all your friends, and you just get plucked out of that year eight class and put into another school across the world and with another group of year eights. And they're like, sort yourself out. That was my anxiety level. Like, it was through the roof. Like, and even throughout training, like, it was just crazy. crazy because I thought I was always late for something. I thought I was not where I was supposed to be, you know, and obviously I was just this outsider. This is how I felt. I was just this outsider coming into a group of guys that have been together since England under 18s, England under 20s, then now obviously Open England. And that's, I just thought that I was just this outsider that was just coming in, and my anxiety levels was crazy because I just thought, what if they're thinking this, what if they're thinking that. And yeah, it's anxiety is also another crippler. It just does you.
It does.
You just overthink. So yeah, no, I agree with you. I think everything needs to be still got a long way to go, but we've made massive progress
recently. Yeah, I've got five questions for you to finish, actually.
Yeah.
Number one, what's your favorite book and why?
Alchemist. And the reason why is because a lot of things in there resonated with my life. The whole journey through the desert storm was my journey through my loneliness, finding, you know, what he was saying, the Messiah that is kind of around in the camp was the guy that I kind of, my Mick Farrell, my Ollie, my Loose Heads, my Mrs. Holly now, is that my Messiah, my guy that is there constantly for me. I don't need to talk to them, you know, every day, but I know if I was to ever text Mick, he's there.
Yeah.
So that's the reason why that's my favorite book.
That's nice. I really like, I'm going to read that actually. I've heard good things about that.
Yeah.
Number two, and this, I get really interesting answers to this one. What lesson have you learned in your life that you kind of, you know, is true, but you kind of hate?
Lesson in life.
That you know is true, that you kind of hate.
Oh, I'm a big introvert.
Really?
So obviously, my missus, she hates it, and I hate it as well, because I'm such a home bird. And if I was to make a plan with someone and say, yeah, come around, or let's go, I'll come around to yours, come to the time of going or getting them in, I'm like, oh, fuck. Can we not just like make an excuse and we can just chill? That's the biggest like thing for me.
I'm like
a
that.
Big introvert. Yeah.
I found this new sense of, I suppose, introversy, if that's even a word, might be, in lockdown. Lockdown, the amount of time I was forced to spend by myself and also my missus, and I was like, fuck, okay, yeah, no, this is actually quite fun, quite like this.
I'm exactly the same. So lockdown, like, everyone's like, oh, lockdown was horrible, I had to spend time with my missus. I was like oh, am I the only one that really enjoyed being at home, winning at Monopoly, of course.
Question number three. Your friend who's having a tough time at the moment picks up the phone, he rings you and says he's having a really bad day today. What do you say?
I either say I'm coming over or come to mine.
Okay.
Or if he says no, I'm still going over.
Nice. Okay, good. I like those. These, there's two questions here in the middle around mental health, which often, do you know what, if you condense this podcast into the last five questions that I'll ask, it helps a lot of people in itself. Question number four, when you're struggling with something, you're struggling yourself, what's your go-to? What do you do to improve things?
Me personally, it's sitting there. Obviously, if you've got these breathing apps, breathe, identify the stress or the anxiety or the sadness that you feel and sit with it and understand it, because the more understanding you have of that struggle, the more options you can see yourself doing. Whether if it's, you know, stress from work, what is it in work that's making you stress? Can you do something to help yourself? Is it maybe just getting a bit more active to help your mind sleep at night, so that when you go to work, you're not as tired? Is it so different things? If you can sit with the pain, sit with the struggle, you'll then identify what you need to do throughout this process, whether it's step by step, whether it's just one thing you need to change throughout your life, whether it's a diet, maybe eating healthier food so that what you put in your body is helping you mentally, helping you sleep better. Because sleep is also another big thing. Some people cannot sleep, and that's why they're waking up like horrible, have a bad day at work, and that cycle is just constantly repeating itself. So yeah, sit with it, breathe, identify the pain or the struggle you're going through, and from that, naturally, you'll find a solution. If it's obviously a lot worse, then it's definitely pick up the phone, call the best mate and talk.
Nice. Number five, I reckon I know the answer to this one. You're lying on your deathbed, looking back at your life. What are you most proud of?
My family.
Yeah, I thought so.
My family, my little girl. It tears me up now. But the way Holly is with my daughter, the way we've kind of just the little things she does for her and for myself, this house. She's like literally the pillar of this house, and that's what I'm really grateful for, and obviously the gratitude that I have for her and my little girl as well. So yeah, definitely my family.
Beautiful. Any more on the horizon?
I hope so. Hoping for a little lad.
Fucking hell! Another Denny Solomona. Jesus,
yeah, mate. I hope because the girl upstairs is literally my little mate. So I think my missus wants a mummy's boy. So hopefully I can give her a mummy's boy, because she's definitely a daddy's girl upstairs.
Denny, we've done almost an hour and 45 minutes.
Mate, I could have gone on. This is easy.
That's good. I'm hoping we can do a rut episode 2 with Denny Solomona and dive deep into
Definitely.
Samoan culture and more into mental health at some stage in the future. Yeah. But thank you so much for coming on.
No, mate. I thank you very much for even thinking of inviting me onto your podcast. And, you know, like I said, I love what you're doing.
No, I saw the Daily Mail article and I was like, this guy's got it relatively sussed and he'd be great to chat about. So, but cheers, look, Paul, you're a inspiration, a role model to God knows how many young kids who are growing up watching Sale, and your ability to articulate and talk about your problems the way you have, both in the media and on this podcast and whatever you do in the future, is just absolutely phenomenal. So
thank you, Paul. Cheers, man. I appreciate the great words. Thank you.
Hey.
I don't know about you, but I was absolutely gripped listening to Denny's story. It's very rare that you find a professional sportsman who is willing to be that open about his battles. But I think actually Denny sees his life in two parts. The first part was filled with feelings of being uncomfortable, dis-ease, and longing to find a place in the world. And it led him down so many dark alleyways, seemingly hoping to find ways in which he could understand himself better, while simultaneously finding ways to escape. And then you have the second half of his life. One in which he's living now with his beautiful daughter and his partner, and building a family which keeps him incredibly grounded and on the right track, and also gives him the ability to act as a role model, a father figure, and see his impact in the world in a completely different way now by educating others on their journeys through professional sports and understanding their journeys with mental health. It is really inspirational. A huge shout out to Looseheads too. Looseheads, who Denny is an ambassador for, and this podcast has an absolutely brilliant relationship with. Looseheads are one of rugby's most prominent mental health charities. They provide amazing initiatives for clubs and players and people to open up and have a platform to break the stigma of mental health. Looseheads work in mental health and rugby, actually. I don't think Denny would have the opportunity to speak as openly as he does now under such an inclusive umbrella, which Looseheads facilitates. So Looseheads, Rob Shotton in particular, you're an absolute legend. Thank you very, very much for facilitating the conversation with Denny. It really, really means a lot, and I think Denny enjoyed it. As always, thank you to Cornerstone for your support. And if you're listening to this, you can get £10 off your first subscription box by following the link in the show notes in this episode. I 100% put them in the show notes, so take a look there. You'll have a link through to our landing page on their website, and make sure you get that first box. It's practically free. I mean, who doesn't want free shit? Have a wonderful Christmas and a brilliant new year, and we will see you in 2021. Bye now.